Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Elizabeth Bishop, A Very Short Introduction, by Jonathan F. S. Post, narrated by Stephen Bowlby. Yes, all my life I have lived and behaved very much like that sandpiper, in her poem, Sandpiper, just running along the edges of different countries and continents, looking for something. I have always felt I couldn't possibly live very far inland, away from the ocean, and I have always lived near it, frequently in sight of it. Naturally, I know, and it has been pointed out to me, that most of my poems are geographical, or about coasts, beaches, and rivers running to the sea, and most of the titles of my books are geographical, too. Elizabeth Bishop, 1976, accepting the Neustadt International Prize for Literature. Chapter 1. Less is More. A World in Miniature. The Bishop Phenomenon. Dear Millicent, I think this would have been a better photograph if the photographer hadn't been so careful to get the sun or moon exactly on top of the mast. The remark, like so many by Elizabeth Bishop, says much in little. It is written on a postcard, one instance in a voluminous correspondence that kept her connected to a larger world during a lifetime of travel. It forms an observation, in this case, of a small seascape with a lobster brought. Bishop always preferred small to large, shoreline to inland. And it is exact in stating a preference, a matter of taste, for the inexact, the off-balance, the imperfect, the line that isn't straight, the seemingly inessential. It often leaves room for error, on her part. Is it an image of the moon or sun on top of that mast? She pauses. She isn't sure. Modesty and boldness seem part of a single mind. I think. In what turned out to be the final year of her life, Bishop sent this postcard to her friend Millicent Pettit, whose house on the island of North Haven, off the coast of Maine, Bishop occasionally rented with her partner Alice Methvessel. Bishop died on October 6, 1979, of a cerebral aneurysm in her wharfside condominium on Boston Harbor. By then, she was a much-admired poet, but not as celebrated as she would become in the years following her death. Where many poets' reputations decline after death, hers has been constantly on the rise, climbing, it seems, with each decade, and in the process, spreading beyond the USA and Canada to England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland, with a distant reach south to Brazil and Australia. Who is this person, this poet? Born in 1911, Bishop came of age as a poet in mid-century, perhaps best symbolized by her appointment as Poetry Consultant for the Library of Congress for 1949-50. And it is fair to say that many now regard her as the finest lyric poet, certainly the most beloved, in the English-speaking world of the second half of the 20th century. True, the names of W.B. Yeats, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, Robert Frost, and William Carlos Williams, lofty modernists from the first half of the 20th century, might be more familiar to the general reader, attached as they often are to a national or international identity. Bishop's name and fortunes ride a different wave. More tied to geographical region than to country, she appeals to readers who identify with the quotidian and the human, but not at the expense of the natural world, rather than with the political state, with the particulars of home and the homemade, rather than the concept of homeland or overarching poetics. I like the way her whole oeuvre is on the scale of human life, writes the American poet James Merrill. There is no oracular amplification. She doesn't go about on stilts to make her vision wider. Her whole oeuvre represents an astonishingly small number of published poems, about 90 in all. The majority are found in the four individual volumes of verse that Bishop saw into print and serve as the primary focus of this very short introduction, North and South, 1946, A Cold Spring, 1955, Questions of Travel, 1965, and Geography 3, 1976. Another 10 or so poems appear in her several volumes of New and Collected Poems, 1969-1983, each volume rather confusingly called at the time The Complete Poems. These volumes also include a few translations and some juvenilia. If you're counting, as I am for the moment, her productivity comes down to about a volume of poems a decade for the years she was active as a poet, or, on average, about two poems published a year. Her last volume, Geography 3, is a mere 10 poems. To make a book out of them, the publishers had to widen the margins. No 20th century poet has gone so far with so little, has made such a virtue out of scarcity. Contributing to the seeming smallness of the corpus, too, is the absence of prolegomenon, preface, or apologia about poetics. Not that Bishop didn't have firm ideas about art, almost from the beginning. But in contrast to all the poets just named, she hardly ever opined in public on the matter. When she wrote prose, and Bishop wrote lucid, lively prose, it assumed instead the form of short stories, especially early on in life. The occasional brief essay or memoir, the rare blurb for another poet, or the vignette, subtropics, as she called them on one occasion, on toads, crabs, and snails. Nothing, in short, that might be considered self-promotional. About the only kind of writing to which one might attach the word vast or voluminous is her private correspondence with others, and vast and voluminous it certainly is. Preciousness not being an inevitable consequence of scarcity, how is it that Bishop made her way to the top? Initially, she was regarded as a poet-poet, although even here the familiar honorific is special. Those who first praised and supported her were themselves unusual in their merit and visibility. They constitute almost a who's who of 20th century poets bordering both sides of the Atlantic. Her modernist mentor in the 1930s and 1940s, Marianne Moore, was a crucial first reader, whom a shy but enterprising Bishop sought out while still a college student. Then came Robert Lowell and Randall Jarrell in the 1940s as admiring peers and reviewers, followed by the slightly younger John Ashbery and James Merrill in the 1960s and 1970s, and many more poets after that, including a hospitable Seamus Heaney, an initially repelled Adrian Rich, and a host of new generation poets from England in the 1990s, right up to the present day. In retrospect, it would be hard to imagine a more substantial pedigree or lineage. How the notoriously reticent Bishop earned the attention and respect of her peers, their loyalty, friendship, and support, is a fascinating story, as the biographies remind us. The support of others depended in part not just on the perceived originality of her verse and her likable presence, but on her epistolary talents for initiating and sustaining friendship through the exchange of advice and affection. Bishop is one of the great letter writers of her century. The ensuing friendships inspired more than a few memorable phrases that capture important qualities of her verse that have become part of the Bishop legend. Here is the final line from one of Lowell's four sonnets to Bishop. Unerring muse who makes the casual perfect. A near-perfect description of a chief feature of Bishop's verse, only near-perfect because Bishop would never think of herself as an unerring muse, it points to the significant shaping of everyday speech in her verse. Bishop can attach a simple word like, yes, overheard on a late-afternoon bus traveling westward, to a line of thought stitched together by perhaps the oldest rhyme in English, with the answering term, death, serving as the proper close, as evening turns into night. Yes, that peculiar affirmative, yes. A sharp, indrawn breath, half-grown, half-acceptance, that means life's like that. We know it, also death. Casual speech, readily accessible, but filled with understanding about how the world turns. From a different angle, here is an admiring Merrill again. Among top-heavy wrecks, she stays afloat, he notes in a brief poem of his own called Her Craft. Merrill's pun in the title captures at once Bishop's preferred means of slow travel by boat and the corresponding long attention she gave to her art, her craft. Her slowness composing poems is legendary, as is her guilt over not writing enough. The quoted line also suggests an aesthetics of survival, the lightness of less is more, as Merrill hints at the overreaching that made wrecks of so many of her generation, including at times Lowell. And now Heaney, writing much later about shifting fashions and the elevation of Bishop over the most famous of mid-century poets in the USA, Robert Lowell. Lowell is taking the punishment that's always handed out to the big guys eventually, so no, I'm not surprised. Lowell was a white, Anglo-Saxon Protestant male, a Eurocentric, egotistical sublime, writing as if he intended to be heard in a high wind. He was on the winning side from the start, Boston Brahmin, friend of Eliot, part of the literary establishment on both sides of the Atlantic, although he was, of course, ever conscious about these advantages and forever making his courtly bows, in public and in private, to Elizabeth and her achievement. But then the fashion shifted. The culture favored a less imperious style. The gender balance needed adjusting. The age of Merrill and Ashbery arrived. Chamber music and cabaret rather than orchestral crash were in favor, and the time was propitious for the perfect pitch of Bishop. Yes, Bishop's perfect pitch. An example drawn again from The Moose. Goodbye to the elms, to the farm, to the dog. The bus starts. The light grows richer. The fog, shifting, salty, thin, comes closing in. The carefully marked pauses, the simple rhyme of dog with fog, allow each word or phrase its distinct note, with a final rhyme bringing this description to a lightly quickened evening close. Other factors of a more serendipitous and scholarly order have contributed to her elevation. As Heaney's commentary suggests, Bishop's emergence as a poet coincided with a widespread admission of women into the academy in the late 1960s and 1970s at both the undergraduate and graduate levels. Although women had long taken courses at Harvard, for instance, the university only became officially coeducational in the years immediately prior to Bishop's teaching there in the early 1970s, in what would be her only continuous stretch of employment. Until then, Bishop had supported herself mainly through a combination of fellowships, a small trust, earnings from her writings, a brief stint at teaching at the University of Washington, and the hospitality of friends. In the case of her stay with her Brazilian lover, the politically prominent aristocrat Lota de Macedo Soares, a short visit expanded to cover 16 years, from 1951 to 1967. And while Bishop always resisted the label female poet, she nonetheless became the beneficiary of a movement that translated her from the narrow province of a poet's poet to a writer who is read in and out of the classroom, inspiring not only other women poets, but future female academics as well. The 1990s alone saw no fewer than 9 critical monographs on Bishop published by female scholars. Bishop's first biographer was a woman, Brett Millier, 1993, as was her second, Megan Marshall, 2015, a former student at Harvard. And although written much earlier, the first critical monograph on her had been written by the poet-critic Ann Stevenson, 1966. Bishop was not just helped by the women's movement, appealing equally, if differently, to both sexes. She helped to expand a diversified readership for poetry in general. As the passages from The Moose suggest, one doesn't need a college degree, let alone one from Harvard, to enjoy her poetry. As part of her emergence, Bishop's conveniently compact canon of often casually perfect poems played an important role, as did her strong affiliation with another female poet, Marianne Moore, and a reticence that was not simply attractive in its own right, but that invited critical and biographical commentary. Bishop, too, played into the hands of further generations of scholars. By saving many of her notebooks, drafts of poems, and epistolary materials, she helped, in effect, to curate a future beyond what was already publicly available in print. These writings now constitute a remarkable personal archive. Held mostly at Vassar College, her alma mater, the materials, at the discretion of her literary executors, have begun making their tantalizing presence felt in many quarters. First came the publication of a large selection of her letters in 1994 that was universally praised, likened by one reviewer to discovering a new planet or watching a bustling continent emerge, glossy and triumphant, from the blank ocean. Then the recovery and publication of her paintings in 1996 in Exchanging Hats, of special interest given the richly descriptive, painterly element in her verse. The letters and paintings were followed a decade later in 2006 by a large stash of unpublished and often unfinished poems, Edgar Allan Poe and the Jukebox. And after that, more letters. The complete correspondence between Bishop and Lowell, Words in Air, a riveting record of one of the great literary friendships, appeared in 2008. It was subsequently made into a play, Dear Elizabeth, by Sarah Rule in 2012, and has recently been reprised, starring Meryl Streep and Kevin Kline. Then, in 2011, her correspondence with The New Yorker was published, telling us much about the grammatical habits that helped her achieve perfect pitch. And in the same year, after the death of her literary executor and partner Alice Methvessel in 2009, a cache of letters written in 1947 to her psychoanalyst, Ruth Foster, came to light, as did the entire Bishop Methvessel correspondence of some 500 pages. Although limited to a single year, the Foster letters gives voice to a number of intimate details involving Bishop's childhood and early adult life that have made their way into the criticism. These materials detail her continued anxiety over her alcoholism, which began in college the year her mother died and was never really overcome. They recount several crushes on girls at summer camp and boarding school, as well as her unrequited passion for Margaret Miller, her Vassar roommate and one-time traveling companion in Europe. They also describe some of her dreams in relation to her poems, her thoughts about her body, the shame she felt over her attitude toward some of her poorer relations, and her fears as a young girl over a particularly abusive uncle, George, the husband of her mother's older sister Maud, with whom she lived, behavior that she fended off and later even managed to forgive, one sign among many of Bishop's remarkable resilience. The sizable Bishop Methvessel correspondence, by contrast, sheds light on Bishop's later years. In 1970, Bishop met the 26-year-old Alice Methvessel, the administrative assistant at Harvard's Kirkland House, where Bishop was staying. These letters, describing an older woman with a much younger lover, offer, in the absence of almost any surviving correspondence with Lotta, the most intimate portrait of Bishop's daily life with another person. By the early 2000s, there was suddenly much to say about this most reticent of poets, who was soon to arrive at celebrity status on a broad scale. International conferences, essay collections, more monographs proceeded apace, as Bishop's canon of writings swelled and seemed in the process amenable to a great many critical approaches and readers in the 21st century. Nova Scotian scholars made much of Bishop's extended family life and her maritime locale, in what has become a tug of war among regional readings of Bishop. Key West, where Bishop purchased a house in 1938, now a literary landmark, and Brazil are the other major contenders. On both sides of the Atlantic, academics continue to trace her literary roots and routes, both deep and winding. Environmentalists found someone who cared about the world, not just the beleaguered self of confessional poetry, a movement Bishop generally deplored. Post-colonialists discovered a poet to critique and or command. Gender critics unveiled a queer Bishop. Scholars of race examined, not always favorably, Bishop's long-standing interest in black lives. Her poems even appealed to the theologically minded, although she was an avowed non-believer. All the while, readers explored the fissure between the inner turmoil of Bishop's private life and the seeming serenity of the poetry. On a more public front, Bishop became the subject of a widely released movie, Reaching for the Moon, 2013, about her romantic years in Brazil, set largely in the beautiful modernist house in Petrópolis, on the outskirts of Rio de Janeiro, that Macedo Soares, a self-trained architect, helped to design and oversee its construction. This film was followed by another, an art film about Bishop's time at summer camp, Welcome to This House, by the experimental filmmaker Barbara Hammer in 2015. More recently, Liza Whelan's 2019 novel, Paris, 7 a.m., the title is taken from one of Bishop's early poems, gives a largely fictional account of her year abroad in 1937. In North America, only the mysteriously reclusive Emily Dickinson has exceeded Bishop in terms of a poet's cinematic and novelistic appeal, and for many of the same reasons. Biographical beginnings. Thanks to a panoply of biographies, if Bishop's life no longer holds the mystery it once did, her poetry, like all great art, continues to do so. And the focus of this very short introduction is to introduce new listeners to her verse, the one truly inexhaustible story of Bishop's life. From this perspective, biography is an important first step, because places and people, heightened by memory and travel, those features of inner and outer geography so crucial to Bishop, are part of the fabric of her verse. Indeed, they ground her poems in the reality she always claimed to be describing. Nova Scotia holds special relevance in this biogeographical literary scheme, and no account of her poetry can afford to ignore it. The Maritime Province was the home of her mother's family, the maternal line of descent that went back generations, while her father's line descended from Prince Edward Island. And although Bishop was born in Worcester, Massachusetts in 1911, the early death of her father from Bright's disease when she was only 8 months old, and the subsequent mental deterioration of her mother, who would be permanently hospitalized in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, when Bishop was only 5, meant that she spent considerable time as a child in Great Village, Nova Scotia. She would often stay with her maternal grandmother in the house still standing near the town center, and which serves as an occasional writer's residence and often the endpoint for numerous pilgrimages to her home country. After her mother's hospitalization in 1916, Bishop lived most of the regular year with relatives in the USA, initially, briefly, and very unhappily with her grandparents on her father's side of the family in Worcester, Massachusetts, then with her maternal aunt and uncle in the suburbs outside Boston. Great Village became a place for summer vacations and holiday visits, as she went off to boarding school at Walnut Hill, 1927-30, then Vassar College, 1930-34. In the later 1940s, Nova Scotia offered a source of personal refuge and poetic renewal as she faced a disintegrating relationship in Key West with her partner at the time, Marjorie Stevens, and a loss of direction and confidence in the immediate aftermath of the publication of her first book of poems, North and South, in 1946, which had been selected out of more than 800 submissions for the first annual Houghton Mifflin Poetry Prize Fellowship. Two of her most vividly evocative landscape poems, Cape Breton and At the Fish Houses, would emerge from these ventures and appear in A Cold Spring, 1955. Seeds were likewise planted for a much later harvesting of The Moose in 1972, when she finally finished a draft of the poem to be read at the Phi Beta Kappa ceremony at Harvard. Bishop's family life had a large hole in the center. She was an only child, an orphan in effect, who suffered much of her life from frequent bouts of loneliness, asthma, eczema, and alcoholism. She thus required constant attention from her physician and lifelong friend, Annie Bauman, and occasional hospitalization. An allergic reaction to the cashew fruit on her arrival in Brazil, in fact, led to an extended visit with Lota that quickly blossomed into a romance. Bishop's early life also included an extensive network of relatives, whose complex Nova Scotian strands require some careful decipherment by her biographers, in a rural community bound together at the turn of the 20th century by its regional, largely agricultural, often church-going, and, in the case of Bishop's family, literate identity. Bishop's mother was called Gertrude, nay Bulmer or Boomer. Her sister Grace, Bishop's favorite aunt, was 10 years younger than Gertrude. Grace would marry a Bowers, and it would be to Grace Bulmer Bowers that Bishop would dedicate the Moose. There was also another pair of alliteratively balanced sisters on the maternal side, Maud and Mary, several Uncle Georges to untangle, as we discover in a late poem called Poem, and on her father's side, the wealthier Bishop side from Worcester, from which she received the modest trust fund that mainly supported her schooling and travel. A stern set of grandparents and 3 surviving children, including Aunt Florence, with whom Bishop lived briefly in 1917-18. Bishop would eventually be buried in Worcester's Hope Cemetery with her parents, but only after a largely unplanned life that included considerable travel in Europe, North Africa, and Mexico, as well as along the eastern seaboards of North and South America. The longest period of her staying in one place was the 16 years she spent in Brazil with Macedo Soares. Their relationship brought much happiness in the early years, but grew to be more complicated and strained over time, as Lota became increasingly involved in the troubled political life of Rio as a commissioner of a new public park, and Bishop sought escape in the provincial town of Ouro Preto, where she eventually purchased the second of her houses, Casa Mariana, named in honor of Mary Ann Moore. Their relationship ultimately ended in disaster. Bishop's letters from this period in her life make devastating reading. An overworked, depressed, and jealous Lota, against her doctor's advice, followed Bishop to New York City in September 1967, and, whether accidental or planned, died from an overdose of Valium, leaving a distraught and despondent Bishop ridden with guilt for years to come. Bishop's gravestone in Worcester came to bear the words, "All the untidy activity continues, awful but cheerful." These are the concluding lines from The Bite, a poem in which the unexpectedly rich detail of a busy Florida bay offers the lonely eye of the writer some company on my birthday, as the headnote to the poem reads. Bishop requested only the last line be carved on her headstone, but Alice Methvessel found it too stark, so the preceding line was eventually added. Together, the lines summon a view of daily life that tilts between emotional extremes, but rarely gives way to either, striking a clarifying balance in the face of things, a chief hallmark of Bishop's verse. The Worcester connection appears rarely in Bishop's poetry, but when it finally does in the Waiting Room, it carries all the weight associated with a return of the repressed. Written in a deliberately compressed autobiographical format, activated by her emotionally difficult return to the USA in 1967 when she began drafting the poem, In the Waiting Room contains the only direct mention of Worcester among her published works. Worcester does figure substantially in her unpublished prose reminiscence, The Country Mouse, which underlies the poem. It is also the first poem in her final volume, the more personally immediate Geography 3, 1976, and it recalls, from a child's perspective, a disconcerting volcanic eruption of self-awareness in a dentist's office in Worcester 3 days shy of her 7th birthday. In the poem, her Aunt Florence appears as Aunt Consuelo. The power of the poem hinges on a layered understanding of the child's frightening identification of herself as female. An O of pain in the dentist's office, where Aunt Consuelo undergoes a procedure, gives birth, in the waiting room, to a young girl's painful, dizzying, disruptive burst into self-consciousness. "But I felt. You are an I. You are an Elizabeth. You are one of them. Why should you be one too?" Yes, one too, a female, that is, because as one becomes two, the young girl, having been made uneasily aware of her body, her gender, and her connection to others, separates from the child and, assuming the adult poet's consciousness, comes into the night and slush and cold of Worcester on the 5th of February, 1918. The date reminds us that the war was on, outside as well as inside. In contrast to this single wintry wartime reference to Worcester, the province of Nova Scotia, the people, the maritime land and seascapes, the animals, the fish, and the birds, served as a recurring source of inspiration throughout Bishop's career. Northern subjects populate all four books of poetry. North and South, 1946, contains The Map and Large Bad Picture. A Cold Spring, 1955, includes a trio of Nova Scotian poems, A Summer's Dream, At the Fish Houses, and Cape Breton. And Geography 3, 1976, includes two, The Moose and Poem. Rather surprisingly, however, memories of Nova Scotia loom largest in her third book of poems, the substantially Brazilian Questions of Travel, 1965, when her stay in that country prompted total recall of Nova Scotia, including the most inspired of her short stories, In the Village, based on her memories of her mother's breakdown in the context of a child's detailed recollection of her now perilous place in that rural community. The story serves as a structural hinge as well in the manner of Lowell's prose autobiography, 91 Revere Street, in Life Studies, 1959. It links the Brazilian poems in the first half of the volume to the Nova Scotian poems that appear under the subtitle Elsewhere, most notably Sestina, Filling Station, and First Death in Nova Scotia, along with several others that mention members of her extended family, her maternal grandfather in the delightfully poised Manners, and her Aunt Mary in the more anxiety-ridden Sunday 4 a.m. Sestina, Another Inscrutable House. To listen to one of these Nova Scotian poems in detail is to understand the brilliant art Bishop made out of a location, in this case, one that bespeaks loneliness and absence. As with In the Waiting Room, Sestina invites us to imagine a setting involving a child who became the poet. First published in The New Yorker in 1956, it is not, strictly speaking, an autobiographical poem, and there is reasonable debate among readers about how much biographical information is needed in order to appreciate fully a poem as artfully conceived as this Sestina. In the Village clearly hints at the usefulness of family knowledge, but such information remains optional because the Sestina itself, at least in Bishop's hands, is so good at establishing a world of its own elsewhere. The strict form of the Sestina requires the rotation of six carefully chosen terminal words over the course of six stanzas of six lines each, with a final stanza compressing all six terminal words into three lines, using two terminal words in each. It sounds complicated, and it is, but Bishop makes it seem as natural as the September rain that begins the poem. Here is the opening stanza. September rain falls on the house. In the failing light, the old grandmother sits in the kitchen with the child beside the little marble stove, reading the jokes from the almanac, laughing and talking to hide her tears. What Bishop describes here is a cosmos within a cosmos that feels utterly real. There really was a stove bearing the brand name Little Marvel. To sharpen the focus, she has reduced the length of the pentameter line usually associated with the Sestina in English to a variably shorter tetrameter, that is, from 5 feet to four, or 10 syllables to eight, in lines 1, 3, and 4. The six terminal words then give us the general setting, house, the principal characters, grandmother and child, some of the properties relevant to the sparse setting and climate, stove and almanac, and the desperate mood, tears. The brilliance of the poem lies in the apparent simplicity of a mysterious story that unfolds in the course of these changing terminal words. This is a house, but not quite a home. We don't know why the grandmother is crying, although she hints that her tears are environmental and seasonal, and are possibly connected, moreover, to a larger world of fate, as foretold by the almanac. Since only the grandmother talks, we're also not sure of the exact bond between adult and child, the family ties behind an afternoon tea time ritual, although the child certainly wishes to please the grandmother by proudly showing her a drawing of a house. The grandmother is also always described with a definite article, the, never the more intimate pronoun, her, just as the child's gender is never specified, although we might suspect it is female. The carefully worked grammar is part of the distancing, the silence, the sestina in cases, as the house grows chillier and the tears become ubiquitous. They show up, rather fantastically, in the tea kettle's small, hard tears, then in the tea in the grandmother's teacup, as if tea and tears possess some occult linkage in this part of the world. They appear again in the buttons of the man in the picture the child is drawing of a rigid house and a winding pathway, and, more magically still, as moons falling from between the pages of the almanac into the flower bed the child has carefully placed in front of the house. Bishop has often been tied to surrealism, as we will hear in Chapter 4, especially in her early poems, where images of dreaming and sleeping proliferate. But here, the surrealism is connected to the everyday. Those strangely mutable tears, and the bird-like almanac, and the inscrutable house the child draws, the last words of the poem. What does it all add up to? One obvious answer is the absent mother, the only person missing from the family puzzle if we allow the man with buttons as a stand-in for the father. But inserting this biographical key has the paradoxical effect of closing the door on the poem. It seems interpretively reductive to fill in a blank that Bishop wants to expose, since the blank is what both grandmother and child are struggling with in their different ways as they fumble through the day. The grandmother trying to hide her tears, the child drawing first a rigid house, and then again yet another inscrutable house. Still, although lonely, the child is not quite bereft. Bishop is careful here, as we must be, but it is possible to see that the child bears a distant resemblance to the poet, who finds in the unrelenting, rigid form of the sestina the evolving potential for unfolding an inscrutable mystery in her own life, the absent mother that Bishop never again saw after she was hospitalized in 1917. It might seem, as it has to some, that by changing the title from Early Sorrow, as it was originally called, to Sestina, Bishop sought to distance herself from the difficult subject matter, treated here some 20 years after her mother's death in 1934. But it is also the case that we hear in the generic title a reference to the ideal recursive form for registering sorrow, the grandmother's and the child's. And the generic title also hints at a further link, that in the child's repeated acts of making, we see an image of survival, a distant mirror reflecting the hand of the maker, the poet. Time to plant tears, says the almanac. The closing agricultural metaphor reminds us that September rain will yield fruit sometime in the future. Amid this bleak picture, there is a place for hope as well as sorrow, just as, upon reflection, an oh of pain can be heard in Geography 3 as a productive part of growing up in Worcester. Filling station and a big hirsute begonia. Place and the memory of it are always crucial forces in Bishop's poetry. This goes for time spent in Europe as well as Florida, but two more Nova Scotian poems will deepen our understanding of this special place in her art and heart. Both poems are from the Elsewhere section of Questions of Travel and illustrate some of the poetic virtues identified by Lowell, Merrill, and Heaney in a context that also hints at the generative nature of Bishop's original family locale and her predilection, as we saw in her postcard, for an art that isn't perfectly strained, but a touch whimsical and off-center. And both, while hardly alone in this capacity, underscore what Bishop identified as the three qualities I admire in the poetry I like best: accuracy, spontaneity, mystery. Filling Station, another mid-career poem, was first published in The New Yorker in 1955. It is probably based on memories of a gas or petrol station across the street from her grandmother's house in Great Village. An Esso station once stood there. Now it bears a different name, Wilson's. But Bishop's description, while detailed, is familiar enough to have a recognizable generic feel and appeal to it. As with Sestina, the poem offers a microcosm of a family, one described from a first-person point of view, which might or might not be equated with that of the poet. It begins with a deliberately off-putting, anxious, but spontaneous exclamation, "Oh, but it is dirty!" Then a father, wearing a dirty, oil-soaked monkey suit, appears with his greasy sons, as further details germane to the setting quickly emerge, familiar to anyone who has ever stopped at a family-run gas station. Things, including the perception of things by a speaker, almost always undergo change in the course of a Bishop poem. Questions are rarely rhetorical, but evidence of curiosity, of thought in process, revaluing the environment in a closer, usually more sympathetic light. And such is the case here. What initiates a swerve in a sympathetic direction is the recognition, amid the apparent clutter, of a big hirsute begonia, and the questions that follow from this observation. Some comic books provide the only note of color, of certain color. They lie upon a big dim doily draping a tabaret, part of the set, beside a big hirsute begonia. In its hairy bigness, the begonia seems almost monstrous, but also slightly comical, as indeed its proximity to comic books might suggest. The small scene lends a touch of color, of art, to the filling station in the manner of a still life. Flowers on tables figure in many of Bishop's own paintings. And as so often is the case in Bishop, the initially extraneous comes to be seen as essential to the poem. Why the extraneous plant? Why the tabaret? Why, oh why, the doily? Embroidered in daisy stitch, with marguerites, I think, and heavy with gray crochet. In contrast to Sestina, the reader doesn't need to discover or impose a missing mother. The speaker searches her out for us, drawn as she is to the embroidery, nestled within a parenthesis, and the apparently feminine hand that waters and orders this small universe. Someone embroidered the doily. Somebody waters the plant, or oils it, maybe. Somebody arranges the rows of cans so that they softly say, "Esso, so, so, so," to high-strung automobiles. Somebody loves us all. The final line seems so simple, and yet is among one of her most mysterious in a stanza that is among her most enchanting, literally. In the repeated phrases and cadences, right down to the elongated, soothing label on a can of oil, Bishop invites us to wonder who this somebody, this fairy godmother of gas stations, might be. To some, she is the benevolent deity of Bishop's much-admired George Herbert. To others, she is less warmly received, the manifestation of Bishop's class consciousness and condescension. In other words, there is a somebody, a mother, who can love even this grease-stained family. To the more politically and ecologically minded, the somebody is a sinister indication of the corporate takeover of the family by Big Oil. To the psychoanalytic critic, she is a compensatory sign for the mother Bishop lost, with the soft saying of Esso cans, often interpreted as spelling a calming S-O, so, 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 or S-E-W, so, 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 although some have read it more alarmingly as an S-O-S, serving as a wishful response to the unheard mother's wrenching scream that spreads across the sky in the village, a scream provoked into being by a dress that didn't seem quite right in its stitching and color. Not all of these contexts are equally persuasive, but one more suggestion is needed. I think it is possible to read this gesture rhetorically, that is, on its own terms, as an evocation of hope by someone momentarily filled by what she has seen. Bishop's poems often end in an open space, leaving us not so much reaching irritably after facts as simply recognizing, as in The Moose, that life's like that. A person, the speaker, moved to questioning the place of things, including her place in an initially foreign setting, like a messy filling station, can sometimes arrive at a better, more generous understanding and say just this sort of thing. First Death in Nova Scotia. The last Nova Scotian poem I want to consider here is the most exquisite of the trio. The poem's title, First Death in Nova Scotia, reminds us of the last line of a Dylan Thomas elegy that Bishop much admired. After the first death, there is no other. Published a few years after Filling Station in 1962, Bishop's poem is, like the other two, one of many triumphs of saying much in little. The poem is, pointedly, not a full-blown elegy. That will come 15 years later, in its own delicately intimate way, in the 1978 pastoral elegy, North Haven, In Memoriam, Robert Lull. Here, Bishop is remembering the experience of a small child's first encounter with death. In this case, the death is of another child, her little cousin, Arthur, in an idiom tightly made for the occasion. The poem is a slender 5 stanzas, spoken by the child. Each stanza is 10 lines, each line 3 feet. The verse line suggests an affinity with the 2 somewhat fanciful poems that immediately follow, Filling Station and Sunday 4 a.m., and the more chronologically distant and longer In the Waiting Room, in which the short line enables concentration on the revelation of a small child's expression and perspective. The diction is also unusually simple and straightforward. It has some of the beguiling clarity of Andrew Marvel's A Nymph Complaining for the Death of Her Fawn. Marvel's poem, cited in her notes from her year spent reading at the New York Public Library, is another diminutive poem about an innocent young girl, or nymph, mourning the loss of another innocent, in Marvel's case, a fawn or small deer. In Bishop's case, the young child mourns the loss of another child, whose death gets curiously fused with the death of a loon. But Marvel's is a pastoral lament, a complaint. Bishop's is quietly, even stoically, set in a cold, cold parlor, overseen by my mother, in a room often thought to be the parlor in her grandmother's house. Bishop carefully depicts a chromograph of named English royalty on the wall, Edward, Prince of Wales, with Princess Alexandra, and King George with Queen Mary. Chromography was a form of color lithography popular in the early 20th century, and Bishop's reference to this process and its subject matter not only gives a dated loyalist feel to the extended family occasion, frozen as it is in the author's memory, it also reminds us that the child's idiom, as we come to understand it, belongs to an altogether different register of speech from that of adult discourse. Into this frozen world, the mother, my mother, makes an entrance. As part of the mourning ritual, she is said to have laid out Arthur beneath the chromographs, and later, in the middle of the stanza, she speaks, "Come," said my mother. "Come and say goodbye to your little cousin Arthur. I was lifted up and given 1 lily of the valley to put in Arthur's hand. Arthur's coffin was a little frosted cake, and the red-eyed loon eyed it from his white, frozen lake." It is a touching moment, the more so if we reckon that, apart from the reference to my mother's watch in One Art, it is the only time Bishop's mother appears in the whole of her published verse. But her appearance is handled, notably, as part of the observed ritual itself. Bishop will not sacrifice the truth of the moment, as remembered, to a retrospective sentimentalizing of the kind she sharply criticized herself for doing with regard to her mother in her 1961 personal reminiscence, The Country Mouse. Quickened by the short lines, our own eye moves rapidly down the stanza to the fanciful figure of Arthur and his coffin as imagined by the child, pairing Arthur with the dead, red-eyed loon, shot and stuffed by Uncle Arthur, Arthur's father, but still alive in the child's imagination. The genealogy seems purposefully dizzying as we follow the child into this rabbit hole of names. To the 4-year-old speaker, the shooting of the loon is as real as the death of the little cousin, and it is this swerve away from the ordering ritual of adults into the child's fanciful way of thinking that is so striking and wrenching as we enter the make-believe world of Jack Frost, not the adult-made world of chromographs, that the later bishop, the painterly poet, clearly and movingly recovers. Arthur was very small. He was all white, like a doll that hadn't been painted yet. Jack Frost had started to paint him the way he always painted the maple leaf, forever. He had just begun on the hair, a few red strokes, and then Jack Frost had dropped the brush and left him white forever. The difference between the two uses of forever, the first in parentheses and capitalized, linking it with a popular Canadian song of that name, draws our attention to the word, is so delicate as to invite a question. In a poem about death, shouldn't the latter, as well as the former, be in capitals? But that would be too intrusive on the part of this poet. She remains faithful to the end to the child's storybook way of perceiving the world, even if that way of perceiving runs counter to what poet and reader know to be true. The gracious royal couples were warm in red and ermine. Their feet were well wrapped up in the ladies' ermine trains. They invited Arthur to be the smallest page at court. But how could Arthur go, clutching his tiny lily, with his eyes shut up so tight, and the roads deep in snow? After the first death, there is no other. Or so it might seem after finishing this jewel of a poem. Howard Moss, Bishop's editor at The New Yorker, wrote about the poem's ending, "The sudden release of the last line in a poem so compressed that each word is utterly necessary has the impact of a memory held under pressure, which is suddenly allowed not to explode, but to expand endlessly." Arthur's eyes are shut tight. Outside, all Nova Scotia lies dead in winter. But it is the word roads that has such large reverberations. Roads are where one goes. Arthur not only wasn't going, he never would be. It is the recognition of this impossibility that the child's question finally admits as the poem comes to its perfect pitch close by rhyming the open, long vowel snow with go, and thereby leaving, too, a small O of pain in the reader's ear. Roads are where one goes, and for Bishop, they took her in many directions, as this chapter has suggested, not to mention extended periods of time in New York City, or trips up the Amazon and to the Galapagos Islands. Nova Scotia will remain an important imaginative place for Bishop, but never a home, just as there will never quite be a mother in her poetry as in her life. There will be people, lovers, places, houses, and she will settle in for a while, but she will never fully put her feet down, except in verse. From narrow provinces of fish and bread and tea, the moose. There is always a part of Bishop that includes elsewhere, and that elsewhere leads to yet another new place from which she could also derive inspiration for her poetry. As she says in Questions of Travel, making a potent simile in the end out of an apparently ordinary scene sketched in the negative, But surely it would have been a pity not to have seen the trees along this road, really exaggerated in their beauty, not to have seen them gesturing like noble pantomimists robed in pink. Yes, surely. Who wouldn't want to be part of this fantastic venture?